Hey there, neighbors. It's a new year out here in the backwoods, and we're glad you joined us. This is Jeff Wright. I'm here with Ben, and we're talking today. I haven't really got a title in mind, but something about our life in the objective room.
Yeah, life in the objective room is what I was thinking.
Yeah. Okay. So life in the objective room, friends. But before we get started, Ben, new year treating you okay, man?
Yeah. We're actually about to get our first, hopefully, big snow of the year. I used to live in, well, everybody knows where I live. I used to live in more central Pennsylvania. We would get real bad snow among the hills there. But out here where I'm at now, we don't get a whole lot. At least last year, we hardly had any. So I'm hopeful we'll get some.
Man, I love where I live. Never wanted to live anywhere else. But the one thing I dislike the most is that it just turns gray and wet in the winter most of the time.
Yeah.
And so I'm fooling with cows. I'm just constantly in this muddy swamp of filth. And I'm ready for that. I'd much rather have snow. In fact, the other day I went out to milk and it was cold enough the ground had frozen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's miserable conditions. Like it hurts to touch a metal gate.
Yep.
But I was like, thank goodness the ground is frozen. I was so excited. So happy to walk on solid ground.
Back when I used to work on a farm, we would have to go out in the middle of winter. And all the water tubs would be frozen over. So we'd go out in the early in the morning and bash the ice with an axe. And we'd come back in and our beards would just be like frozen solid.
Uh-huh. Yeah. This is totally not related to our episode, but I'm going to say it. Yeah.
This is our first banter episode.
Well, we got to quit because we got to get to the objective room. But
yeah,
when I hear these like liberal PETA, not, you know, idiots, they're like, they don't care about animals, they're so cruel. I'm like, go watch a farmer go out in the frozen cold of awful and bust ice and tell me they don't care about their animals. What, you know, watch them hold a dead calf and I have tears in their eyes because they didn't get to it on time, and tell me that you know, socially isolated freak shows.
It's like dairy cows get treated better than I do.
Oh my gosh, no doubt. And they act like it too. So yep. Anyway,
they know who they are.
Exactly. They know their value.
All right. So the objective room. This is going to be diving into one of both of our favorite books, That Hideous Strength by C.S. Lewis, part of the Ransom trilogy, which at some point I think we should probably we're going to have to do an episode just about That Hideous Strength, or maybe a series just kind of going through it, because there's so much richness in there.
Yes. And I would actually... I've been thinking about this. I'd like to line up some guests for that. I think it'd be fun to do a series of like people that we've talked to about this. You know, maybe like no names on social media or whatever, but that we know have a really good insights. So I'm all about that.
Yeah, and I mean, I want to do Paralandra as well. Which, as much as I talk about That Hideous Strength and how important it is and how it was life changing for me, I think Paralandra is actually my favorite of the three books.
Dude, have we ever talked about that?
We may have in the episodes we did about Ortlund on That Hideous Strength.
It is 100% the case that Paralandra is my favorite in the trilogy. And maybe, I mean, I love Narnia. But it may be, because Paralandra feels like grown-up Narnia in a sense. Paralandra is by far my favorite, yeah.
Yeah. I remember this one time, I was listening to the audiobook of Paralandra, and I was driving. And it was one of the temptation scenes. And it made me so uncomfortable because he captured so well what temptation is like. Like, you can't argue with it. There's no rational argumentation. Satan's always got, you know, better tricks than you're going to have if you try to just, you know, fight on his terms. It made me so uncomfortable. I had to like pull over for a minute and just think about what I was listening to, because I was like, this is what temptation is like. And it was just bothered me so much. But yeah, excellent book. Not the one we're talking about today, though.
Right. Kind of sets it up in some sense. Yeah. But that point, see, this is what I'm going to have a series. But like, he made me realize how Gnostic I am when it comes to my sanctification. That like, I want to just stare the devil down. And like you just said, that's losing ground. You have to like physically, as an embodied being, move yourself. Literally fight if that's what it takes. You know what I mean? Like, I remember thinking those, what I used to think of as like cringy Christian movies, like Fireproof, where the guy's out there like hacking up his computer hard drive. And I'm like, Yeah, you might ought to hack up your computer hard drive. You know what I mean? So
I remember, so, you know, a friend of mine and I do that podcast where we like watch Christian movies and talk about them and stuff. And Fireproof was the first one we did. And I remember talking about that scene in particular as really one of the only good scenes in that movie, because it's when he's sitting at his computer and he faces some temptation. And he just rips the computer out, takes it outside and beats it with a bat. And that was like, because it was one of the few scenes, we're going way off topic here. There was one of the few scenes in the movie that had some kind of subtext where he was like actually fighting his sin in beating to death that computer. It was excellent. But yeah.
I'll try to quit taking us on to sidebars. I'm enthusiastic about the idea of doing a series on the space trilogy.
Yeah. Real quick, just because we're here. I love the scene we're referencing in Perelandra when Ransom finally comes to the conclusion that you're talking about. And he says, "In the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost, here goes. I mean, amen." And then he hurled the stone as hard as he could into the unmanned's face. Like, it's such a great line.
So good, man. And it's Lewis in a way that I don't know that many other authors could do it. Taking like high theology, practical theology, and narrative skill, and being like, this is what Christian faithfulness looks like in, you know, in an alternate world, but in a way that's immediately portable over to the real world.
Yeah. So the objective room, in that hideous strength, there is a character, Mark Studdock, who has been sort of being snookered in by the bad guys, although he wants it, so it's not really totally being deceived, but he's being brought into the company of the bad guys, the NICE, and kind of the final step of their catechesis of him is bringing him into the objective room. So do you want to talk a little bit about what the objective room is and why they call it that?
Yeah, I think that's good. So the way I think of the objective room is that it is the final exam in a curriculum of dehumanization. So what you just said about Mark is an apt summary of kind of his narrative arc. Mark is a man of ambition, and he has come in contact with NICE, who wants to take humanity under controlled evolution to become something that is inhumane. Like, they want to strip away what they call sentimentality, all the things that make us distinctly human, and they want to turn us into kind of efficient meat robots. Well, Mark's not aware of that. He just sees this as a prestigious institution, what we would call a think tank now, to become involved in. And Lewis's principle of the inner ring, which we've talked about, but that's also a must read. There's a little essay called The Inner Ring you can find widely on the internet.
We can reach out to that.
Yeah.
In the show notes.
Yeah, yeah. But the idea is that basically through social pressure, a man can be made to do things that he would never do if they were presented to him objectively. Hey, would you write an article that you know will turn federal authorities in on innocent families? No, how dare you ask me to do that? But if you're in a social circle long enough where people talk about how those kind of families are so awful and such a pox on society, and somebody really needs to do something, by the time you get around to the opportunity to write the article, you've been groomed into the kind of person who would write that article without thinking about it, right?
Yeah.
And there's a version of that for Mark in the book. So the inner ring pulls him in a way that you couldn't have if you'd have just came and said, this evil thing I want, would you participate in it? So Mark is going through that process, and the people who run the institute think they have him far enough along the curriculum. He's made enough compromises morally. He has signaled his kind of craven allegiance to the inner ring enough that they think they can bring him into this objective room as the final definitive, I said test, but it's like this is what will not just show that he is what we think he is, but it also will make him as a final stage of development what we want him to be.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly from the book, there is sort of a doubt about Mark at this point that they have, and so they kind of push him into the test maybe earlier than they might have wanted to, because they just need to deal with him, because there, if I remember right, there are signs that he's maybe not totally on board at this point.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And this right. So the objective room in this case is, it's almost a punishment as well. Like, we're going to strip everything away from you that makes you human by putting you in this room.
And I think in the narrative, it's like, you know, when hot steel is plunged into cold liquid to like harden it and make it the final form, you know?
Yeah.
So, and so Ben, why they call it the objective room, you know, I've off air thrown you some of my thoughts. You have thoughts on that?
The thoughts I have are going to be basically what you're going to say. It is almost, an ironic name, because these people reject objectivity in pretty much every form except one particular one. And they almost call it the objective room as like a cruel joke.
Yeah.
That there is nothing really objective.
Mm-hmm. Except that Christ has to be blasphemed.
Right.
This is one of those times where you can tell, like, that hideous strength is predictive prophecy, because this final test is kind of the chief example of how the entire enterprise of the Institute is built on gaslighting. There's a time where Mark is talking to Ferry Hardcastle, I think, and they have this little, actually it may be Dimble. I may have it completely wrong, but they have this kind of discussion of like, can the objective exist, in chapter 9? And then at the end of chapter 9, Lewis, as sort of an editorial, authoritative narrator, puts this comment into the text. Ransom, obviously, is the protagonist. The NICE is supposed to be this scientific enterprise that's going to marshal all the modern resources to make humanity better. Well, he says, the sciences, good and innocent in themselves, had even in Ransom's own time begun to be subtly maneuvered in a certain direction. Despair of objective truth had been increasingly insinuated into the scientists' indifference to it, and a concentration upon power had been the result. And so, you see Marxism there, right? Like, nothing's really objective. Mm-hmm. Just impose your will on the material world. But they still use the language of objectivity when it's useful for them.
Yeah. So, I want to read a short portion from the book, and it is when Mark is put into the room and he begins to recognize what's going on. There's two characters in the scene, Frost and Mark, and then they mention another character, Wither, at the end. But I'm going to go ahead and read that. He says, he turned his back on the pictures and sat down. He understood the whole business now. Frost was not trying to make him insane, at least not in the sense Mark had hitherto given to the word insanity. Frost had meant what he said. To sit in the room was the first step towards what Frost called objectivity, the process whereby all specifically human reactions were killed in a man so that he might become fit for the fastidious society of the macrobes. The macrobes, I should pause here. The macrobes are sort of Lewis's name in this book for these higher demonic powers. So microbes are very small creatures. Macrobes are these very large creatures. And in this case, demonic. So he says, so that he might become fit for the fastidious society of the macrobes. Higher degrees in the asceticism of anti-nature would doubtless follow. The eating of abominable food, the dabbling in dirt and blood, the ritual performances of calculated obscenities. They were, in a sense, playing quite fair with him, offering him the very same initiation through which they themselves had passed, and which had divided them from humanity, distending and dissipating Wither into a shapeless ruin, while it condensed and sharpened Frost into the hard, bright, light little needle that he now was. But after an hour or so, this long, high coffin of a room began to produce on Mark an effect which his instructor had probably not anticipated. There was no return of the attack which he had suffered last night in the cell. Whether because he had already survived that attack, or because the imminence of death had drawn the tooth of his lifelong desire for the esoteric, or because he had, in a fashion, called very urgently for help. The built and painted perversity of this room had the effect of making him aware, as he had never been aware before, of this room's opposite. As the desert first teaches men to love water, or as absence first reveals affection, there rose up against this background of the sour and crooked some kind of vision of the sweet and the straight. Something else, something he vaguely called the normal, apparently existed. He had never thought about it before, but there it was, solid, massive, with a shape of its own, almost like something you could touch or eat or fall in love with. It was all mixed up with Jane and fried eggs and soap and sunlight and the rooks calling at Keir Hardie and the thought that somewhere outside, daylight was going on at that moment. He was not thinking in moral terms at all, or else, what is much the same thing, he was having the first deeply moral experience. He was choosing a side, the normal. All that, as he called it, was what he chose. If the scientific point of view led away from all that, then be damned to the scientific point of view. The vehemence of his choice almost took his breath away. He had not had such a sensation before. For the moment, he hardly cared if Frost and Wither killed him. So, the objective room, it's not described in this passage, but it's a room, and we've talked about this before, it's a room where, you know, the corners of the walls don't quite align right. There are stairs to nowhere. There are grotesque paintings and pictures and just things that ought not exist in real human life. And they're all designed to create a reaction of stripping away the natural reaction to the ugliness, to strip away all of those human feelings, those sentiments that you talked about, and to make you think nothing of the obscenities that you're seeing, to strip away your humanness. But what happens to Mark in the room is that he sees all of these things, and in seeing them recognizes that there is actually a normal, that all of the obscenities, by virtue of existing, tell of something else that exists that is not obscene. And that reaction he has, it is what turns him toward the normal, what is right and good. And I think I included this last line, even though it's not quite part of the description, because I think it's so important, that last sentence. For the moment, he hardly cared if Frost and Wither killed him. And I think that line is significant because it shows what happens when, in the face of, you know, being bombarded with the quote unquote objective room, when you choose the normal, it actually frees you.
Mm-hmm.
In a way.
And so, it breaks your loyalty to the inner ring.
Yeah.
And reasserts your loyalty to God's natural order. Right.
Yeah.
Your loyalties have just shifted. I don't care if you kill me. I don't want your approval. I don't even need you to leave me alive. You're so inconsequential in comparison.
Yeah. Yeah. And this section is so good. I love that he says it's mixed up with Jane, who is Mark's wife, fried eggs and soap and sunlight. Like it's just all things. The things that are the opposite of the objective room are the things that are real, the things that are natural, the things that are good. Mm-hmm. And when you're bombarded with the objective room, it can, the right reaction to it is to love the normal.
Well, it's also sort of a Calvinist conversion sense. Like, I was thinking, you know, it just got my wheels turning listening to you read it. Early in the book, Mark is described as of use to the Institute because he's a man, like, I think the line is literally something like, he's a man insensitive to beauty.
Mm.
And so they realize he is the kind of person who it's easy for their machinations to work on.
Yeah.
But here, you know, something in God's providence, I think because of what's happening at St. Anne's, God's providence breaks in and just sort of remakes him. So like the objective room does what they intended. It changes Mark, but God inserts himself and imposes himself on their designs and makes it something glorious. You know, I mean, like the layers, as you start peeling that thing, it gets more, what Lewis writes gets more glorious as you peel each layer.
Yeah. Yeah. And so
if you don't mind if I jump in real quick.
Go ahead.
The other thing I was thinking, we've, I think, talked about this, but if not, we just need to make it clear. That Hideous Strength is Lewis doing a fictional version of what he did in essay form in The Abolition of Man.
Yeah.
And in The Abolition of Man, there is a curriculum, the Green Book, that basically launches his criticism of modernism as it is trying to destroy humanity, turn humanity into men without chests. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you see how this is curricular in nature. And the end goal is to be someone who is disembodied intellect. Yeah. Basically, that the again, you're a man without a chest. You're completely governed by your head, and the body is almost obsolete. You only need it to interact with certain things so the mind can do what it wants to do. But Lewis here, in Mark's, you know, divine intervention in Mark's life, it's the taste of eggs. And I mean, based on the end of the book, I think literally the beauty and desiring the beauty of his wife mm-hmm. that snaps him out of this. And like, just all of a sudden he's now a human. He's now much more human than he's ever been.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. And so I think for the listener, it's probably hopefully obvious how this idea of the objective room is relevant to us today. Because we are subjected to it nearly every day of our lives, in media, in just the world around us. So I thought what we could do next is move into what are some examples of how, you know, the regime, the powers that be, are trying to do this same thing, putting us in the objective room today.
Well, Ben, if you'll let me, I'd like for us to do this part. And then, you know, I said like the objective room is the final test. I would like to go back and just highlight a few things that have groomed us into this point.
Yeah. No, let's do that. Let's do that first. And then we'll get to the examples.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, I'm only going to be able to do this basically from my own lifetime, you know?
Yeah.
And I can do it a little bit as a student of history, but you have to, you know, humanity, when we talk about humanity, we're basically talking about the image of God within us as human beings, or that we live in as human beings. And that is such a powerful thing that suppressing it really does take sustained effort. And so, like what Mark is like this capsule version, you have to be groomed into the final horror blasphemy that the bad guys running the world want. And so you might go back to the Enlightenment. You might go back to the Darwinian Revolution to just kind of sample, you know, where we're at now. You don't just trot out trannies and say you have to call them, you know, this guy a woman.
Yeah.
In my own life, that had to start with things like, well, we want to disconnect sex from reproduction. And so here's a pill that will let you have sex without having any offspring. It'll stop you from being fertile, in the sense of producing. And then that will let you think.
Go ahead. Real quick, just as an aside, I just recently my wife was listening to the Gavin Ortland episodes again, and I listened along to a little bit, and you talk about the scene where Ransom and Merlin are talking down about, you know, Jane's down in the garden or whatever, and they're talking about her intentional barrenness. And so this is something that Lewis had directly in mind.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah, go on.
So, you know, you say, well, look, you can have sex without creation, basically, or sub-creation, right? Well, then it becomes a leisure activity. Then it can become, because it's so pleasurable in a sensory experience, it can become the reason for existence. It now can become a kind of counterfeit telos, right?
Yeah.
Which is what our society did. And once sex becomes a counterfeit telos, you can remake your body in its name, right? Because the body's not what's important, even though it's the mechanism by which you receive the pleasure. And it just becomes the material that, Marx, Nietzsche, all these super cynical guys would say, just impose your will on it, you know?
Yeah.
Another one that I think grooms us into this is something like, hey, look, sometimes you just have to get a divorce and the kids are going to be okay with it. You got to be happy. The kids will adjust. You know, there's all this like cope, rhetoric we use to say you can fracture the fundamental human relationship that God blessed with the ability to create new humans through. It shapes us for all human society. You can break that apart willy-nilly, and the people who are clearly going to be the most catastrophically devastated by it, well, we're just going to tell you they're going to be fine. Kids are rubbery. They're like Gumby. They'll bounce back.
Yeah.
Right.
I recall when I think it was Joshua Harris and his wife split up a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and they posted these big things on social media that made it sound like, you know, if I decided to get another job, like it was this right. amicable split, and, you know, we're happy for your future prospects. And, you know, we had such a good time together, and, you know, but now it's time for us to move on from each other. It's like you are soft selling this so much, not like trying to, like you said, it's a cope, because you're destroying like the fundamental fabric of society, destroying the lives of your children because what, you don't feel in love anymore?
Oh yeah, exactly. And really what you're trying to do to the kids is impose the objective room on them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you see this in movies where kids are like, well, we'll get two Christmases. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like they're all trying to figure out how to put a good smiley face on this. I mean, really, in scientific, you know, reality, Oppenheimer, that movie came out. I never saw it, but I'm aware of what Oppenheimer did. The splitting of the atom releases all this tremendous destructive force. So does splitting the home.
Yeah.
So does splitting sexual activity from God's design for reproduction. But we have just we've just been groomed toward the objective room by pretending like, yeah, it's no big deal. What are you talking about? No big deal.
You talked about gaslighting earlier, and that's exactly what this is. It's like, oh, the kids will be fine. They'll get two Christmases. They'll be able to, you know, we'll split time evenly. We'll co-parent. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, you are trying to engage in your own sinful lusts, and you are lying to yourself and the world around you. And by imposing that lie on the world around you and requiring everyone to accept the truth of it, and this is the same thing with transgenderism as well, you are actually putting, you know, your own little spin of the objective room. You're bombarding others mm-hmm. with it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, you know, I think we talked about this on the conspiracy theory maxing, but that kind of, like, normalizing that kind of obvious nonsense and treating it like something you cannot see no matter how bright it is.
Mm-hmm.
Sets us up to live in a world where they will look at you with a straight face and say, that's not a baby. That's just a bundle of cells.
Yeah.
You're not killing anything. You're just having an abortion.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like the Biden administration trotting out all these trannies in military garb and being like, that's, you know, that man decided he's a woman. And so he is a woman and you must agree, or you're not only going to be excluded from society, but we're going to try to impose on your conscience that you're a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
And so that in some ways, that's the sort of conspiracy of the objective room. It demands the whole world participate in the lie.
Yeah. And when the people who are trying to impose that lie on the world are in power,
mm-hmm.
it is... you know, it's actually a hard thing not to repeat the lie.
Yeah.
Because you can lose your job, your life. I mean, that's why I included that line of Marx at the end, because what are the consequences here of not accepting the obscene as normal? It could be your life.
Yeah. And it could be you losing your life in the sense of not just being murdered, but thrown into a hole that nobody can hear from you ever again. And God knows what's happening to you in there. You know, with a weaponized government, your home can be invaded and your children taken.
Yeah.
I just saw that Amish guy, I think in Pennsylvania, I could be wrong, but that Amish guy in Pennsylvania.
Not too far from here.
Just was raided again because he dared mm-hmm. to sell like chicken he raised and milk that hasn't gone through a cooking process, you know?
Yeah.
So they have multiple ways. If you know, there's somebody out there who would say, I don't really care that you take my life. So, you know, this has always been the Christian's great advantage against tyrants. You can kill me. I'm not excited about that, but I'm happy to make that trade because I just end up in paradise. right? But, you know, they have these other methods like, well, what about if we took your kids and subjected them to forced re-education and made monsters out of them and we left you alive to watch it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's multiple ways that they can, quote, unquote, take your life from you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so what we're getting at here is that we haven't just been in the last, what, 5 years? When was the Bruce Jenner thing?
Dude, that's a weird deal. It feels like with COVID, like it feels like it was yesterday and also 20 years ago.
Yeah, right. Because I feel like in my mind, Bruce Jenner, you know, coming out or whatever, was the moment where transgenderism became the norm. Before yeah, that, you know, it was a thing, but everybody kind of just like we all laughed about it. But that was the moment when it became like you have to agree with this. Mm-hmm. And that's not when this started. This is what you're getting at. We were catechized into accepting that long beforehand.
That's a societal inner ring. Like good people think this way. And you're not going to be a weirdo who doesn't agree, right? So here we are.
Right. Right. So that's how we got to this point, but I want to talk a bit about just, not necessarily to prove our case, because I think anybody hearing this already recognizes this is true, but just, some examples I've seen recently of how we are being bombarded with the obscene, like the objective room, we're being gaslit. The thing that made me think of this first, and I think I messaged you that day and was like, we need to do an episode on this, is when Jill Biden posted that Christmas from the White House video.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this bizarre, unnatural, like gross, grotesque reimagination. I think it was the Nutcracker was what they were doing.
Yeah.
And it was just... It's almost hard to talk about it because like that scene from the book that I read, there's not a thing you can really put your finger on, but it awakens in you the sense of this. There's something obscene here and there's something else that's normal.
Yeah. It's Uncanny Valley kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I didn't watch the whole thing, but I saw that video and I was like, this is wrong. Like there's something grotesque about this, but it's
there's a difficulty in describing objectively something that is inherently chaotic, like they're doing something that's designed to confront reality. And so if you want to realistically describe it, you're like, well, it's sort of this awful thing, like a dog that is whole, but you get up to it and you realize it's dead. I mean, it's hard to find apt comparisons.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's why I love the way Lewis describes this, because he doesn't put a lot of time into describing the room itself. I mean, he does tell you, you know, it's like I said, the corners of the walls don't line up. There's stairs to nowhere, weird art and things like that. But the way he describes it is in that it makes its opposite known.
Mm.
Like you see the grotesque and you know there's something that's not grotesque. And that's how I felt watching that, you know, the Biden Christmas video. This is obscene in a way that I maybe can't quite give you chapter and verse. This is why this is obscene, but I know it is. And I know that there's something that's not. And I can tell you what that is because, you know, the entire world is filled with it naturally. Like it is the good, the right, the normal things that are according to natural law.
Yes. And I think it was Owen Barfield who kind of famously said about Lewis that everything he thought about anything was contained in what he said about anything. So like you had all of his thought always present wherever you encountered any of it.
Mm.
And I'm remembering that, you know, in the apologetics, Mere Christianity, you know, he says we wouldn't be able to recognize a crooked stick if all the world was a crooked stick. We'd have no concept of a straight line. But it's because we inherently know what a straight line is, we recognize crookedness.
Yeah.
And it's also why it's so great that kind of the bad guy, what we would, you know, Satan, behind all the evil of the Ransom trilogy is called the Bent One among the spiritual beings. He's bent. And bentness shows up in everything he has his talons in.
Yeah. Yeah. And the goal, I almost said the objective of the objective room, but the goal of the objective room is to destroy that distinction in ourselves, mm-hmm. that we no longer know bent from normal. And when that's the case, everything is then bent.
Yeah. And you, you know, I'd like to take another run at that heat of strength before I said this, but I think that may be Lewis describing the precondition for possession, where you become entirely subjective to demonic will. Mm. Because your humanity stripped away, you're now an empty house.
Yeah.
And you were talking about the macrobes. There's a character in the book. So one of the two, gosh, get your head straight, Jeff. One of the best reasons to read the book are two of the characters who are like the executive leadership of NICE, Frost and Wither, mm-hmm. because they show where this program goes. Like, if you're like, what would it look like to be a man without a chest? What would be the termination point of that? These men are fleshed out for you. I think it's Wither who can never say anything straightforward. It's this word salad that's always going around the answer that's been requested, but never gets there.
Yeah.
And the guy named Frost is, he's just like his name. He's cold. He's basically what is supposed to be pure intellect.
Yeah.
Until the end of the book, when he finds out that he's a passenger in his body, and his body starts doing stuff that he can't account for, and is clearly not the product of his mind. He starts attacking people. I think he ends up, spoiler alert, I think he ends up setting fire to himself. And the way Lewis describes it is, this guy is going, why is my body doing this? And Lewis never, I don't think, in the Hideous Strength comes out and says, well, a macrobe took him over. But that's like the subtext. You know, you thought your intellect was supreme. Turns out all you did was clear the space for an actual entity that's happy to have your body.
Yeah. What are some other current day examples of the objective room being imposed on us?
Yeah, getting ready to record this, I was talking to my wife, and she said, you know, I text my sister all the time with like, oh, I saw this piece of art, or I saw this thing, and we just text back and forth the objective room, you know? So once you learn to see it, you see it everywhere. I think the big examples are what we've talked about, like trannies, abortion as healthcare, everything that the Biden administration or the Obama administration ever trots out. Actually, let's just go here, Ben. We'll just do this for our listeners. What day are we recording this?
Day is January 6th.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a great example.
Yeah.
You aren't allowed to know that Capitol Police invited people into the Capitol.
To the Capitol building. Yeah.
You're not allowed to know that Antifa had people embedded there along with FBI agents to incite. You're not allowed to know about Ray Epps. You're not allowed to ask about Ashley Babbitt, who got shot. The only thing you're allowed to do is scream and wail about the assault on our sacred democracy so that you feel okay that they took those people and buried them in a hole for basically the equivalent of saying, oh, I thought we were allowed to come in here and look around.
Yeah. And many of them without trial. Just locked away. And the fact that, you know, if you don't call it the insurrection, you know, you're this crazed maniac who denies history, who thinks that, who doesn't believe that our government was almost overthrown by grandma on January 6th, carrying her little flag into the Capitol building because she loves America so much. Like, if you don't believe that that's what actually happened, you're the insane one.
Yeah. If you think the obvious maniac in the buffalo headdress who's just running around being a troll.
Yeah. Escorted by the Capitol Police.
Yeah. If you don't see him as basically the equivalent of the Confederate Army in the Civil War, you know, you're some monster who can't be trusted to live among free people.
Yeah, and it's so absurd when you just state it plainly. Like, well, obviously the U.S. government wasn't almost overthrown. Nobody was in real danger except, you know, the one woman who, Ashley Babbitt, who was not, she was one of the, I don't even want to call them protesters, they the tourists there.
Yeah, the unticketed tourists.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is why the death of Norm Macdonald was a judgment on us, because, you know, it's him and Dave Chappelle at this point who are like secularists who'll tell the truth,
yeah,
and do it in a way that's compelling. But, you know, that tweet of his that, like, I like how the violent insurrectionists were sure to obey the velvet ropes. Yeah, right. You know, guys like that would be so helpful right now. But guys like, you don't get to have it. You didn't appreciate Norm the way you should have. So I'm taking him, you know.
Yeah. And it is complete absurdity, but it is imposing this non-reality on us and telling us not just that you have to, you know, behave in a certain way. They're telling us you have to think in a certain way. You have to believe a certain thing or you can't be a part of polite society.
Mm-hmm. And this is where Orwell meets Lewis. You mm-hmm. know, I think Lewis wrote the best dystopia. I like Bradbury next. Orwell gets a lot of attention. I can't remember the guy who wrote Soylent Green, but Orwell's strength is that he knew the point of what, you know, the point of this is going to, the point of evil is going to be expressed through their insistence that they can change the narrative moment by moment, mm-hmm. However they want, and your compliance is required because that is... that's the final sign that they have taken over. I mean, you're kind of possessed by the secular state.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They have subjugated your will entirely.
Yeah. And this is why Lewis is so much better, because he recognizes that the possession that's taking place isn't just the state control of your mm-hmm. mind. It's right. a real spiritual battle happening. But yeah, that's exactly right. And even in Orwell, it is a stripping away of your humanity.
Sure.
Of the, like, the goodness and the rightness. He doesn't get all the way there because of who he was, but that's what it is. It is the tearing down of your humanity, the stripping away of the love of what is right, natural, true, and good.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, and probably more so than, I say probably, much more so than the insurrection is the whole COVID nonsense we had to live through for years.
Yeah.
And it was at every level. You know, oh, so this respiratory disease that's super fatal actually it impacts elderly people most, and therefore we have to love grandma and not get together for Christmas. So why are you warehousing COVID victims or COVID sufferers in nursing homes? Is that a bad idea? Right. Well, you can't know that. You can't notice that, you know, from our own narratives, what we're doing is inhuman and foolish. Yeah. And now you're not allowed to remember that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like now that sort of the COVID mystique has been broken.
Yeah.
When you run into somebody who's still subscribing, they'll say, well, you're just denying all these death figures. And the answer to that is I'm not. I'm denying that they were necessary and could have been, couldn't have been avoided, because at the time, the people y'all called conspiracy theorists were saying, maybe don't put grandma in the nursing home if she's got COVID.
Yeah.
And driving up the death numbers. I just saw a tweet from a guy this week. It was a picture of him hugging his girlfriend. And he said that was from, like, I don't know,
yeah, early 2021. I saw that.
That's the last time we've been out. We're still not going to restaurants. And I mean, I'm like, man, it's not just that you're stupid. It's not just that this is full blown insanity.
Yeah.
It's that I think you're probably either going to be possessed or possessed already. And it's just working its way out, because you are Frost. You know, you are what Big Brother wanted you to be in Orwell. Like,
yeah,
think it's about, far beyond just stupidity at this point.
Think about, I'm going to reread a section of the quote from the book because it's directly to this point. It says he understood the whole business now. Frost was not trying to make him insane, at least not in the sense that Mark had hitherto given to the word insanity. Frost had meant what he said. To sit in the room was the first step towards what Frost called objectivity. the process whereby all specifically human reactions were killed in a man. And that, more so than insanity, I mean, think about the way people treated each other when they were under the COVID regime. Yeah. Like there was no, I remember, you know, I had to fly a couple of times when all of that was going on. Nobody talked to each other. Everyone was suspicious of each other. There was no natural, you know, human kindness or goodness to each other. I mean, people would scream and yell at you if you went into a grocery store without a mask on, as though you were going to cause the death of all mankind.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the point of things like the mask mandate or just the COVID thing in general. It's not so much to see if you'll obey. It definitely is part.
Yeah, exactly.
That's definitely part of it. But that's not, I don't know that that's the end goal necessarily. The end goal is to strip away everything in you that makes you human, so that then, you know, the macrobes can descend.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I mean, maybe those run concurrently, you know, I think it's pretty fashionable in our circles to say that COVID was a test run, and probably with this coming election, we're going to get another even more pronounced version of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So they're probably running it like, how much control do we have?
Yeah.
You know, if you're a basketball player and you hit a couple shots in a row, it's common to talk about a heat check where you just take a wild shot to just see how dialed in you are. Right. And it feels like the government took a heat check and said, well, how much can we get away with? And what they found is that our people in the West have been groomed far enough along that it's pretty promising, you know, for their effort. The same deal too, that just talking about where we live in the objective room. You can't notice that multiple major cities stop counting electoral votes, election votes in the middle of the night in unprecedented fashion. And Biden had a huge spike sometime around then that looks like what happens in Sandinista-controlled third world countries where their puppets are installed through quote-unquote, you know, democratic
free and processes. Fair elections.
Right. You know, if you even like raise an eyebrow, well, yours is just as bad as the Buffalo headdress guy, who's the equivalent of, you know, Benedict Arnold.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's absurd.
It is. It's comical. If you're a sane person and you live in the normal world, it all looks like a carnival. But it's actually the objective room.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a good point, is that when we talk about it, you know, we're talking about it all at once, just laying it out there, and it's obviously absurd and comical. But when it happens a little bit at a time, and this is what we were talking about being groomed into it, you know, it happens one little stage at a time. They take a little bit more, they take a little bit more, take a little bit more. And suddenly you found yourself in the objective room, and they tell you, you need to stamp your foot on this crucifix, which is in the book, the ultimate end of the objective room is Frost tells him he needs to stamp. I think it either is a crucifix or it's a picture of one, but he needs to stamp his foot on it. Yeah. And he needs to stamp his foot on it. And it, for us looking at the situation, it's like, Mark, how did you get here? But it wasn't just all of a sudden Frost brought out the crucifix. It was a moment by moment, long, slow, steady, malleability,
gotcha,
and submission toward that direction until you finally get to that moment.
Yeah. It's just a repeatable principle, man. You know, our education system does it to us. Mass media does it to us. Our regnant institutional authorities and the government and quote unquote journalism. That, I mean, it really is that kind of conspiracy. And, you know, you're like, gosh, there's not, you know, these people can't coordinate something that big. No, you're right. The devil of hell can, and he does through them because they have become useful to him in that way. They don't have to be. I think some of them are calling each other. I think, you know, the Time article about how all these people fortified the election are a pretty dead giveaway that there are some people who are coordinating.
Yeah.
But even if they never call each other, they're getting orders from the same high command. They're like terrorist cells. Well, I mean, we know how this works. They may not know each other, but there is one central organizing figure who's sort of distributing it to the loosely connected network.
Mm-hmm. I think about There's this great stand-up comedy bit that came out recently. I don't even know who the guy is.
Is he Australian?
Yeah. The guy where he's like, I'm not going to do the bit, but he's talking about how he was so disappointed in himself for getting the vaccine, and he wishes he hadn't, because it showed that he had a principle, but it only existed insofar as it didn't inconvenience him.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as the principle inconvenienced him, he wasn't allowed to go to a bar for a month. He failed on the principle. And he says, I would like to think I would have been one of the guys in Germany who wouldn't have turned in the Jews. He's like, no, I wouldn't have been that. I would have been like, mm-hmm. I can't go to the bar for a month. Anne Frank's in that building. I saw her.
Right. I mean, you hate to laugh at it, but it's literally what we watch play out.
Yeah. And I'm just, as an aside, the ending of it is great because he's like, and I have to live with that mm-hmm. for the next 2 to 3 years until I have a heart attack.
Right. Cause he's probably triple boosted. Right.
So yeah, he's got the vaccine. Right. But it's comical, but it's a real point. That's one of the great things about stand-up comedy, actually, is they can tell you extremely true things and make you laugh about it. But it's real. Like, we think we are so protected from becoming Mark, but really, unless we're actively making war against in our minds, who was it? Adrian Rogers, there's a war for your mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is Adrian. Yeah. Hey, he's one of the greats.
Yeah.
There is a war for your mind and for your body. Like, there's a war for all of you, and all of these examples of the objective room imposing obscenity on you are incursions in that war.
Amen. So what do you do, Ben?
Yeah,
how do you break out?
That's a great question. How do you live life in the objective room? I was thinking about this question. I think I'll just go over a couple of things and we can probably flesh them out. But, just one, and this is easy when you're living in the objective room, because just like Mark, seeing the obscene, you know that there is something that's not obscene. You know that there is a normal. And so that's the first step, knowing what is the normal, what is the good. And, the great thing about living in God's world is that you can't escape knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's made you, he's ordered you according to it. And so even when you're very distant from it, you know there's something wrong. Like, that's inherent in us as human beings. And so knowing the normal and then cultivating a love for it. I mean, we've talked about this probably a number of times in the past, but just cultivating properly ordered loves toward what is normal and good.
Yeah.
I think of reading old books. You said touch grass.
Right. I mean, touch grass really is important.
If you want to flesh that out a little bit.
Yeah, I think you have to go directly engage regularly with the natural world. So I have mm-hmm. proposed this for people who live in cities. And it's going to sound nutso, but I think it's important. And, as culture is increasingly homogenized in the great sort, it will become important even for those who don't live in cities, but like, you need to remember that you're dependent upon a higher power, and he expresses his goodness to you through these natural laws that you're required to participate in. So, like, again, I know I'm going to sound crazy to a lot of people, but commit this year, I'm only going to eat tomatoes that I grew myself.
Mm-hmm.
And just treat it as a spiritual discipline. I will not order, I won't go to the grocery store and buy a tomato. Unless, I'm going to have to grow it, or I'm going to go without it, because that forces you back into the kind of natural world. Now, you're doing it artificially, but it's because you live in an artificial distortion system that wants you to think that tomatoes will always be available. It's easier for me because, like, I go out every day and I've got these cattle, and like, for the cattle to support themselves and be worthwhile to own and not drain my family, they have to raise a calf every year. Well, when I run into an animal that's hard to get pregnant, that starts becoming a real risk to my family finances. So, like, it's easy for me to walk out the door and have to deal with it. But if you're not someone who's conveniently it has convenient access to that stuff, you're going to have to do some pretty dramatic things, like I just said, where, dadgummit, I'm going to reconnect with the natural world. And you're going to get really invested in not just making tomatoes thrive, but being abundant. And you're going to learn what it is to be crushed when they don't produce, you know, and to ask God to bless the work of your hands as you attempt to cultivate, you know, productivity. And again, I realize that sounds crazy, but we're so far into the objective room, you have to do some dramatic, drastic stuff to break free.
Yeah.
Build something, you know, that's the other thing, like get some wood. Although it's, you know, everybody's like, wood came down. Yeah. Not enough, but build something and build something that has to bear weight. And that, you know, that's important to you. I don't know what that would be because I'm not a carpenter, but like get into natural law of load bearing, because what they want you to do is be like, well, I can always order the thing I need from Amazon and it'll be that way forever. We've created a utopia where it's all 2 days away via Prime shipping. Yeah. That's what I mean by touch grass. Like go figure out some way to be dependent upon natural law in a way that matters. I'm not saying in a way that's going to, you know, give your kid pneumonia. But in a way that you're like, dadgummit, I would love to have marinara, but I can't make any because the tomatoes didn't turn out.
Yeah. I'm actually, it's here soon. I've got all the stuff to brew my own mead. So
that's my
touch grass.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. Make your own beer. Just do something that's not dependent upon the bad guy's good pleasure to let you have access to it. Yeah. And then share it with somebody. You know, that a productive household really is probably the terminal point we should think about, where like, then I can invite a neighbor in to love well by sharing this good thing that I've made and provided for them.
Yeah.
And Ben, then I would go that, you know, when you're talking about how do you live in the objective room, all the things you said are right. In that hideous strength, what's so critical is that there's a society of people who are living counter to the endeavors of NICE and opposing it in warlike fashion. Yeah. So you need a society of people who are doing this alongside of you. And that should be your local church. It should probably involve your family if it can. But I'm sure there's people listening to this be like, dude, I feel like I'm on an island.
Yeah.
This is one of the gifts of the internet. Like I wouldn't know you. We've still never been in each other's physical proximity. But
we were at one point, we were like a couple miles away, but couldn't make it work.
Right. That's one of the gifts of the internet right now. It's a portal to hell, but it's also a place to find people who encourage you, you know?
Yeah.
And in that way, you just insist on living a normal life. That, I guess, is really the crux of it. Like, you're not a bad person for being like, your mask is stupid. It's not going to work. I'm not going to wear it. It's weird that the election went that way. It's weird XYZ. It's weird that these evangelical leaders told me I wasn't loving my neighbor if I didn't shoot myself up with experimental serum. You know, just insist on living normal. It would be the other thing.
Yeah. One of the things I was going to say is, and this happens in that hideous strength, but I think of, I'm going to sound like a nerd for a moment here. My apologies, but there's this old Star Trek, The Next Generation episode where Captain Picard has been captured and he's being interrogated. And the guy interrogating him has these four lights blasting on him. Do you know this? It's pretty widely known even outside of Star Trek. Okay. Well, he's being interrogated. He has these four lights blasting on him and he's just like the first step of the interrogation, you know, he's been starved. He's gone without water, gone without sleep. And the interrogator keeps asking him, how many lights are there? And he says, there are four lights. And the interrogator says, no, there's five lights. And then, you know, continues the process of trying to get this character to say there are five lights. Because he knows as soon as he gets him to say there are five lights, when there are actually four, he can get anything else he wants out of him.
Yeah.
And
we've always been at war with East Asia. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. It's in every dystopian story, there's this moment. And what I would say is we live in those moments every day. He's a woman. Say that he's a woman. Use the pronoun. All you have to do is just, you know, it's kind. It's practicing gender hospitality or whatever they called it you know, it's just being, it's loving your neighbor. All you have to do is say he's a woman. That's it. But as soon as you do, you're under control. You have, you know, in the terms of that hideous strength, you have stamped your foot on the crucifix. You've said that what is real isn't real. And as soon as you've got to that point, you know, all bets are off. Now, that's not to say, I want to be careful here. That's not to say if you ever have, you know, used the pronoun that you can't come back from that.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that too. Yeah.
Yeah. But so if you're going to talk about it, I'm going to avoid it. As soon as you get to that point, that's where you're under control. And so the way to live life in the objective room, even if it seems silly, is to reject the obscene, mm-hmm. reject the grotesque. Even if the only way you can do that is in your mind, is when you see these things, is to say, no, he's a man. You know, no, I won't wear the mask.
Mm-hmm. I will pursue a woman and have children with her because it's good.
Yeah.
Right. Like that. I mean, that's that hideous strength point. But I mean, we live with an evangelical class that's in deep lockstep with the regime and the regnant globalist. There's too many people on earth narrative. And so they're like, no, singleness is a gift. Here's this mm-hmm. Christianese way to yep. deny what's obvious. So like, just be a human. Be what humans have been since the garden, in what remains of the image of God and what his designs were for us as he clearly articulated them.
Yeah. It's such an important point. Just reject I'm going to sound like Alex Jones here, break the conditioning. Just reject it. And what'll happen is, just like Mark, for the moment, he hardly cared if Frost and Weather killed him. Because you have this vision of the normal and the good and the true and the beautiful, you will be free. You won't be under control. And it may turn out, you know, worst case scenario, they do kill you, but you'll die free.
That death will be but a temporary thing if you're trusting yes. Christ, right?
Yes, right. Absolutely.
So on that point of like, what do you do? It could be that somebody listening to this is like, oh my gosh, I failed the test.
Yeah.
And I think that realizing you failed the test is what keeps some of the psychos locked in on the narrative. I think they know that they're wrong. But if they acknowledge that outwardly, they have to deal with the fallout of the way they treated people and how gullible they were. And, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. there are people who stake their careers on obvious nonsense. They're doctors. They're whole institutions like the CDC that can never acknowledge what they did because it would be the end of all their credibility forever.
Yeah.
Right? And I've been thinking about this a lot with evangelicals.
Yeah, that's a great point. I didn't even think about that connection. But for instance, there's been a recent uptick in the people who are like, well, you know, there were some people who got wokeness wrong. There mm-hmm. were some people who got COVID wrong, and we just need to accept them back and forgive them.
Exactly.
And there's an element of truth to that. However, there are some preconditions
mm-hmm. to accepting them back. And we know the route to accepting them back.
Yeah.
As Christians, you know, this is right. not obscure. So again, right. you know, if you're just, Ben and I are on the same wavelength about this, just to make it explicit, one of the great objective room narratives that we haven't talked about is critical race theory saying you as a white person cannot despise any black person for being black, but you are racist.
Mm-hmm.
And that perspective that all white people are inherently in moral compromise because of their whiteness is not a statement of racism on our part, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can be racist, and you can demand these other people are racist, and it'd be the complete opposite, but that's what you have to agree with. And so with COVID and the ongoing washout of the sexual revolution, evangelicals in institutions have gotten this catastrophically wrong for the better part of a decade at this point.
Yeah.
But I think some of them, one, are realizing they got it wrong, and maybe having a sincere Christian kind of reckoning. Others are realizing they're going to lose their income if people connect the dots on what they've said, right?
Yeah.
So what they've done is this cynical rebrand. My kids are playing loud. If anybody's getting to hear that, I'm sorry. I'm in a house with a bunch of cool kiddos.
No, I don't apologize.
But J.D. Greer is the the epitome of this. So J.D. Greer preached an infamous sermon on God whispering about homosexuality, minimizing it as a sin. He went on to say we should practice what you called, you know, pronoun hospitality. Well, you know, several months ago,
was that him who said that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think he was dependent. I mean, he's probably working from Russell Moore. J.D. has never had an original thought. He just finds the worst popular teacher and does a bad counterfeit, you know. So he got on the Gospel Coalition several months ago and said, hey, we shouldn't use pronouns. Never a word of I was wrong. Mm-hmm. Here's what I should have said. It was a total we've always been at war with East Asia moment. There's a guy named Josh Howerton who pastors, I say that loosely, a multi-site church, and that's why I say pastors loosely, a multi-site church in Texas. And he has multiple women on his staff. He's currently rebranding as a non-woke edge guy. Eric Reed in Tennessee is another mm-hmm. version of this, where they want to be seen as sort of like, you know, I guess the best terminology is like the based bros who, are telling the truth straightforward. But they set out the whole wokeness thing. They're wrong on egalitarianism. Both of them are deep buddies with Beth Moore. Mm-hmm. But they don't want you to know any of that and connect the dots, right? You can't know that. All you can know is that they're now saying the things that cost them nothing to say because men who actually had something, who risked something, said it a couple years before them while they were dead quiet.
Yeah.
So Eric Reed can LARP as a conservative guy because Tom Askell actually lost his whole board at Founders Ministries, right? Yeah. And Eric's never going to do it. Josh is never going to do it in a way that cost them their friendship with Beth Moore or cost them their friendship with Dean and Sarah, who also sold the, you know, who's basically been catastrophic on sexuality. He's kind of a great value J.D. Greer on this topic. So that is continuing to fail the test, right? The objective room is a test. If you failed it by stamping on the image of Christ, if you're like Dan Darling and said in a public forum, evangelicals who don't get the vaccine are not loving their neighbors, you failed the test. What do you do from there when you realize it's wrong? You don't rebrand. You repent.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You own your error. You publish it. You identify, here are the steps I'm taking to make sure I don't get it this wrong again.
Yeah.
But that's not what's happening. So I talked to Rosaria Butterfield about this because she has been one of the people on a platform who has said, hey, I was wrong. I need to repent of where I was wrong before. And she obviously has a lot of resources. She's under the care of a really good session at her church. There is her husband is a wonderful godly man who's helping her with all that. Mm-hmm. And what she said is basically, Thomas Watson taught me that course correction is counterfeit repentance. Mm. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a whole bunch of course correction that is a continuation of the failure of the test.
Yeah.
And so Josh Howerton has a way back in. It should involve the words, I was wrong and I resign. Yeah. But the way you can't get back in, and this is one of the ways that I think I really would ask our listeners to hold the line on being normal, is to constantly say, you don't get to come back in this way.
Yeah.
You're still failing.
Yeah. We're more than willing, you know, to welcome
absolutely
you back in.
I'll become your biggest cheerleader.
Yeah. But it requires repentance.
It requires repentance. Because if you don't do that, you're going to betray us again later.
Yeah. You're just setting yourself up to fail the next test.
Yeah. Denny Burke at Southern Seminary recently blocked me because he basically tweeted this. Hey, you guys who were right while all of us were quiet and wrong, you guys who were right need to be humble and let us keep running things now that we've realized the problem. And I was like, I mean, dude, internally, you know, I tweeted pretty aggressively back at him, but internally I was furious.
Yeah.
The narcissism and hubris of that is unchecked.
Yeah.
But that's the play. And he blocked me for saying no. And I'm not anybody, but what I want to signal to him is evangelicalism is not going to fall for this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing I would ask. Don't be a butthole about it, right? I don't want anybody to run scream at the trannies at the drag queen story. That's fine if you want to do it. I'm not telling you not to. But that's not the way forward. The way forward is to say, I was wrong. I repent. And yep. I'm not going to make it easy for people who want to avoid the hard work of repentance.
Yeah. And one of the difficulties with this, I think, is that a lot of these people, especially the ones who are in leadership, they don't really want anything to change.
Yep.
None of the root issues that got us here. They want to be like, okay, you know, we're not going to talk about COVID anymore because I messed that up. Let's keep going the way we were going.
Mm-hmm.
And what we really need, to stop having to live in the objective room is we need a new set of leadership.
Yeah. Ooh. So, and Ben, not to make this forever, but I think this is you're right. And this is a sinister moment for us. So we need elites, but we need them to actually be elite on merit.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of guys, I need to really write about this, and maybe we ought to have an episode about it, but there's a whole bunch of guys who have kind of credibility in the better circles of Reformed evangelicalism who want to just reboot the inner ring of Big Eva,
mm-hmm.
but do with it their with guys. Their buddies.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they just see it as a vacuum that they can fill. And maybe they're mm-hmm. doing it with, you know, with good, like, well, because it's me and my friends, it'll go better this time. It's naive. Yeah. If that's the case, but that's the best version of it. But we've got to be really careful on that exact front. Like, we do need some new elites, but they're going to have to be the ones who pass the test and yeah. passed multiple tests and aren't making room for the guys who failed the test to sort of worm their way back in.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the names doing that, I think, are going to be, it's going to be disappointing to some of the people who probably like our podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. It's what makes it difficult. You know, I'm thinking about how do you live in the objective room? Well, you're going to have to not follow these guys.
Mm-hmm.
The ones who have failed the test over and over and are now course correcting, you don't accept them back into the fold. Don't, yep. Don't repost their articles and their blog posts about how, you know, actually COVID was horrible and using the pronouns is a bad thing now. Don't celebrate that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're just giving them a track back to being in leadership and failing you again.
Exactly. And if you're going to respond to it in any way, it needs to be like, hey, you never owned yeah. and repudiated this previous statement. And we remember.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Is there anything else we need to talk about?
I mean, there probably is, but I don't remember it. I'll remember it after we end the episode.
Right. No, I think we pretty much covered it all. Yeah, I guess just final word. We are living in the objective room. And the encouraging thing is that because we're living in the objective room, we see every day that its opposite is real and it exists. And we don't have to, bow the knee to the objective, to what they're imposing on us, the grotesque obscenity. We don't have to bow the knee to it.
Amen. There's only one Lord. And we bow to him and nobody else.
Yeah. That's all I've got.
Yeah, man. Let's take it out on that.
All right. So you can find us at Backwoods Belief on Twitter. I'm Bendel Wary on Twitter and Gab. Please go ahead and, I guess, rate and review the podcast if you're so inclined. I don't care that much if you do.
I like it. Hey, I care, guys. And I'll try to even read them online if I can catch them. Cause I mean, I like the feedback. I like to just hear from somebody like, hey, this is what I thought about your podcast, and yeah. reviews are one of the ways we can get that.
Yeah, no, actually one thing I would like to hear, and, tweet at the Backwoods Belief account. Like, what are some ways you've seen the objective room and how do you combat it in your own life?
That's a great question.
All right. And how do people find you, Jeff?
I'm merely J Wright on Twitter, mostly. I have ambitions to be available on other social media platforms this year, but I hadn't achieved them yet. I hadn't achieved them for a couple months before now, so someday.
Same. All right. Well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon.